trembling violently, listening, convinced now that the killer is nearby, that he has murdered the rest of them without a sound. And then she is fleeing back to the hotel, reckless on the ice, slipping and sobbing, terrified that she will be next. She aims for the hotel, which is hulking in the dark, desperate to get back to the lobby, to the light of the fire. Alone in the lobby, Henry and his wife sit frozen in silence and fear. He watches her stare into the fire, which is starting to falter. He needs to add another log. Somewhere out there, David is searching for Matthew, who is armed and possibly a killer. Riley and Gwen are outside. He can understand why James and Bradley felt they had to go after the two women, but once they did, he doesn't see why Lauren and Ian had to go after them too. He's angry at them for choosing Riley and Gwen over him and Beverly. Now, he and Beverly have been left to fend for themselves. What if the killer comes for them? He watches his wife carefully. He no longer feels a shred of affection for her. He loves his children. That hasn't changed. But something about her fills him with revulsion. He thinks of her flabby white thighs, the veins that run in little maps along her legs, her breasts that are too heavy, the perpetual look on her face of being fed up, as if life is only to be endured. But it's more than that. It's the way she views him. Overweight family man, a bit of a fool. Someone whose life is mostly over, who will never do anything interesting or exciting again. Just her presence near him, knowing that she believes this about him, makes him hate her. What had she said to him? It's just a phase. She diminishes him. She always has. Jilly doesn't do that. She admires him. She finds him interesting, attractive. She told him she wants to spend the rest of her life with him. She won't get tired of him, as Beverly says. His wife doesn't want to spend the rest of her life with him, but she would, if this hadn't happened. All she thinks about is duty, the tyranny of the shoulds. I should do this, or you should do that. You should be home more. You should spend more time with the kids. You should try for a promotion. He gets up to stir the fire. He reaches for the poker with his right hand. Oddly, time seems to slow down. He grasps the poker very tight. She's sitting right there. It would be so easy. There's no one here to see it. He could run outside after the others, make up some story. He grips the poker tight. David feels his way across the woodshed floor, sliding his feet along in case Matthew is there, somewhere, on the floor. He calls his name, but gets no response. He forces himself to get down on his hands and knees and feel around on the sawdust-covered floor for Matthew. He reaches the stump they use for chopping wood, feels its rough surface with frantic hands. All he finds is the flashlight. Riley huddles in the forest, her entire body shaking with fear and cold, reliving some of the worst moments of her life. Memories of victims, screaming, suffering, dying, bear down on her. She presses her hands to her ears to try to block out the noise, but it doesn't work because the tumult is inside her head. She closes her eyes tight to stop seeing, but it doesn't help because the images are in her mind's eye. Matthew hears someone approaching the library, someone who is trying not to make a sound. Without warning, outside the French doors, the clouds part to reveal the moon, and a glimmer of ghostly light filters into the library. Matthew stands facing the door. He has his gun in his hand, and he knows there are several bullets remaining. And then he sees David appear in the doorway. "Oh, it's you," he says. He explains, "I thought I heard someone in the woodshed."
"You'd better give me the gun."
Matthew hands the gun over. Sunday, 1:45 a.m. When Gwen opens the door and stumbles into the lobby, she's almost surprised to find Henry and Beverly still there, exactly where she'd left them, except that Henry is standing near the fire with the poker in his hand. He starts and drops the poker suddenly, and it rattles as it strikes the floor. She half expected to find them dead. David appears suddenly from out of the dark near the staircase. Matthew is with him. She almost faints with relief. Henry turns from her to David and Matthew and asks, "What's happened?" "Nothing. We're fine," David says bluntly. "Where the hell is everybody else?"
Gwen whispers, "Outside." Her entire body is shaking.
Henry says, "Riley ran outside when she heard the gunshots. The rest of them went out after her."
"We can't find her," Gwen says. "She won't answer us. It's so dark. The others are still out there, looking for her."
She can't stop trembling. "Jesus," David says. "We'd better get out there. We need to find her."
He sounds desperate.
He turns to Gwen and says, "You stay in here with Henry and Beverly."
"No, I'm coming with you."
She will stay close to David. She'll be safe with him. They have to find Riley. "Are you just going to leave us here?" Henry splutters. Nobody answers him. Chapter 28. Matthew slips off the porch and vanishes into the night. David watches him go, wondering about the wisdom of all of them tearing off in different directions. But they have to find Riley, and time is of the essence. They can cover more ground if they spread out. It's freezing out here. "Is she wearing a coat?" David asks Gwen. She shakes her head, mumbles, "Just a sweater." David swears under his breath. They make their way along slowly. David can hear nothing but the howling of the wind.
"Is anybody out there?" he yells.
The wind tears the words from his mouth and they are lost.
"Anyone?"
he tries again, cupping his hands around his mouth.
"I'm over here."
It's Ian's voice coming from somewhere in the direction of the drive.
"Anybody else?"
David yells. And then, less faint, from not so far away, Lauren answers.
"I'm here, on the east side, near the trees. I haven't seen her."
This is impossible, David thinks wearily. He can't see the hand in front of his face without the flashlight, and the rest of them have no light at all. He can barely keep his footing. He turns to Gwen.
"What do you think she'd do? Where would she go?"
Gwen looks at him blankly, her face close to his.
"I don't know. I don't think she's thinking at all. I don't know if she'd run down the driveway to the road or hide in the trees. I have no idea."
"There are trees everywhere," David says miserably.
He cups his hands around his mouth and calls,
"Bradley! James!" "I'm here,"
James shouts back. It sounds like his voice is coming from David's right, west of the hotel.
"I haven't seen her either, but you can't see anything out here. She's not answering. Where the hell is Bradley?"
David suddenly feels anxious. Why hasn't Bradley answered? Maybe he's already made it into the woods and can't hear them. He and Gwen make their unsteady way forward toward the forest. They're almost across the lawn to the trees when David hears a muffled cry and the sound of someone falling down. And then it's a penetrating cry of pure pain, coming from somewhere behind them to their right.
"James!"
David calls wildly. He turns and tries to hurry toward the sound. He hears Gwen panting and scrambling behind him.
"Bradley!"
It's James's voice. The desperation in it makes a chill run along David's spine. David stumbles and slides faster and faster, frantic to reach them, leaving Gwen struggling to keep up. But when he finally sees James, he wants to close his eyes and block everything out. His weak flashlight picks out the dark shape of James bending over Bradley, who is lying still, apparently lifeless, on the ice-covered snow. David comes closer until he is almost upon them. Bradley lies face down in the snow. He'd run out without a hat, and there is an ugly, vicious gash at the base of his skull. Blood is spattered all over the snow. James looks up at him, his face almost unrecognizable in his grief.
"Help him!" he screams. "You have to help him!"
David kneels in the snow beside him and shines the feeble light on Bradley's face. His eyes are closed. His lips are blue. He looks dead. David feels for a pulse. He can feel nothing, but for a moment he hopes that's because his hands are shaking, frozen and numb. But it's no use. There's nothing. Bradley is dead. James begins a terrible keening. It's the most dreadful sound that David has ever heard, a loud, despairing wretchedness, the sound of a father mourning the loss of his only son. He can't bear it. He looks up at Gwen and sees fear reflected back at him. He sits back on his heels and wants to weep himself. He hears others approaching noisily. He shines the light toward them. He sees Matthew, and behind him is Lauren.
"What happened?"
Lauren cries before she reaches them, before she can really see.
"Stay back," David warns.
He rises unsteadily to his feet and splays the light around. He spots something dark dropped in the snow. He lurches toward it, some dark shape with blood on it. He's seen it before. It's familiar. He looks at it for a bit longer, and then he recognizes it. It's the iron boot scraper from the front porch. Someone picked it up and must have used it to murder Bradley. Who? When? A stranger? Or one of the people who came out here to look for Riley? He whirls around again to face them. Lauren steps closer into their little circle of light and stops abruptly. She looks down at Bradley in the snow, his father crouching over him.
"Oh, God," she whispers, taking it all in. "Is he..."
"He's dead," David says dully.
"Oh, God, let me..."
"Stay back," David says again. "There's nothing you can do for him. It's too late."
"Are you sure?"
She's hysterical.
"He can't be dead. He can't be."
She tries to get past him to Bradley.
"Maybe he's still alive. Maybe we can still help him."
He shakes his head and stands in front of her, blocking the way. She begins to cry and beats her hands against David's chest, sobbing.
"There's nothing you can do," he says.
He hears someone coming closer, his breathing heavy as he approaches. Ian looms into view, takes in the scene.
"Oh, no," he says.
Ian watches James weep, collapsed onto his son's body. His shoulders jerk spasmodically as he sobs. It reminds him of his mother's endless weeping, her relentless grief. He turns away.
"We can't leave him out here," David says finally, his voice low. He doesn't have to say what they're all thinking. If they leave him out here overnight, the animals will get him. The coyotes, the wolves, and God knows what else, Ian thinks to himself.
Finally, James slumps back in the snow, his eyes vacant.
"Does anyone have any charge left in their phone?"
David asks.
"I'd like to take a photo before we move him."
They all shake their heads.
"Damn,"
David says.
"What are we going to do with him?"
Ian asks David quietly.
"I think we should take him to the ice house," David says. "It will be easier if we take him through the hotel rather than all the way around the building."
Ian nods wearily and turns to Lauren.
"Help James back inside. We've got this,"
he says, indicating him and David and Matthew. She nods and waits as David slowly nudges James back to his feet. Once they've gone ahead, Gwen trailing miserably after, the three men try to pick up Bradley and carry him. But it's impossible. They can't carry him and remain upright on the ice. They end up dragging him. They leave a smear of blood along the snow. Then they lift him onto the porch and inside, into the lobby. They put him down on the floor for a minute to rest. Ian straightens, catching his breath, and looks up to see Beverly and Henry staring aghast at Bradley's body. They are both speechless with shock. Ian looks away, back down at the body. David tells them, "We're taking him to the ice house." They go back out again to look for Riley for as long as they can stand the cold. This time, they all stay very close together. They are afraid of one another. But Riley is not answering their desperate pleas. It's bitter cold and pitch dark, and the going is impossible. They can't find her. They will never find her. She doesn't want to be found. Sunday, 3:10 a.m. Beverly watches them return, silently, without Riley. One by one, they shrug off their coats and boots and slouch toward the fire in defeat. Beverly thinks Riley must be dead, like poor Bradley. She's almost glad they haven't found her, because she doesn't think she can stand the sight of another corpse. She has never been so close to death. It feels as if death is standing over her, just waiting for the right moment. It's an awful feeling. Beverly thought she caught an odd look on Ian's face in the shadows when they brought Bradley in. Something cold in his eyes that she hadn't seen before. It gave her a chill. She's not sure. The expression was so fleeting, she might have imagined it. Gwen slumps on the sofa, numb. Riley is out there, dead or dying. It's all Gwen's fault. They shouldn't have come. She looks down at her hands. They're shaking. She's beginning to realize that almost any one of them could be the killer. Henry stares moodily into the fire. Three people are dead, and maybe Riley too, but his wife is still here. He failed, interrupted at the last moment. He had hesitated for too long. Coward. But they might have come back just as he'd finished bashing her brains out, and then they'd have been on him like a pack of hyenas. His wife appears silently at his side, kneeling down by his chair, making him jump. It's almost as if she's read his mind. "Henry," she whispers, her voice so low that he has to lean his ear down next to her lips to hear what she wants to tell him. He can smell her breath. He wonders if she can possibly know what he's thinking. "I think I know who the killer is." He raises his head and looks at her frightened eyes, gleaming in the dark. Chapter 29. Ian doesn't like the way Beverly has been looking at him. She's gone over to her husband and is leaning close to him, whispering something in his ear. That's interesting, seeing as usually she's stayed a good distance away from her husband lately. He wonders what she's saying. Maybe something about him. Ian sits in the dark, thinking in the shadows. Henry would like to figure out who is responsible for these murders. He really thought it was Matthew and David, two unconnected murders. But Bradley's murder changes things. His wife has been whispering in his ear, has almost persuaded him now that it's a madman who is doing the killings. And she thinks Ian is the killer. She thinks there's something wrong with him. But if he committed the murders, Beverly thinks Lauren would have to know. They're always together. She would have to know. Henry gives this some consideration. His wife has a lot of irritating qualities, but stupidity isn't one of them. He looks at Ian now with narrowed eyes, trying to see what his wife sees, trying to imagine him killing someone. He finds that he has no difficulty imagining Ian as a killer, because Henry has learned a thing or two this weekend. He's learned that he himself has it in him to be a killer. He finds it's not that big a leap, after all, to imagine anyone else as a killer either. He wonders if Lauren is covering for Ian. He studies her from across the room with a new interest. He doesn't know how far she would go for love. Love is so much harder to understand and predict than hate. Lauren shifts uneasily in her spot on the sofa. The wind still howls and slams against the windows. It's gloomy in the lobby, the oil lamp guttering softly on the coffee table, and the fire needing attention again. How long will it be until the police come? She surveys them all sitting around the fire. How different it is from when they first arrived, Lauren thinks, remembering cocktail hour Friday evening. How cheerful everyone had been, how relaxed. She thinks of Bradley gaily mixing drinks. She thinks of the handsome Matthew, now so changed, and his bright, shiny girlfriend who was lying in the ice house. She thinks of Candace with her scarf wound around her neck. She would like to know who David thinks the killer is. She doesn't know what's going to happen next. James reels with shock and grief. He keeps turning things over in his mind. He remembers how a couple of years ago, Bradley had begun dealing drugs. He thought he'd seen an opportunity to make some easy money, but it hadn't turned out the way he'd expected. Suddenly, James shakes off his apathy and, springing up out of his chair, cries, "Who did this? Which of you killed my son?" He feels an overwhelming grief and rage. Why in God's name would anyone kill my son? His voice is wild, accusing, as he looks at each of them in turn. He can see that he has frightened them. David rises and approaches him, tries to calm him, but James doesn't want to be calmed. He wants an answer. "I don't know, James," David says. "I'm so sorry, but we will find out. You will know who murdered your son." "One of you killed him."
"Unless there's someone else here," Lauren reminds him shakily.
"There's no one else here," James screams.
Then he collapses back into his chair, puts his face in his hands, and sobs. Sunday, 3:30 a.m. Despite how late it is, Lauren is wide awake. Everyone is glancing uneasily at everyone else and then looking away again. Everyone but Henry and Beverly. Henry and Beverly are sitting side by side now and watching her and Ian intently. She finds it unnerving. She wonders what they're thinking.
"Why are you staring at us like that?" she says to Henry at last, her voice sharp.
"I'm not staring," Henry says, quickly averting his eyes.
"Yes, you were," Lauren accuses him. "Is there something you want to say?"
The air is sharp with tension. She doesn't care. She wants to know why he's looking at them like that, and she wants him to stop.
But it's Beverly who speaks up, surprising her.
"I thought I saw something."
David turns to Beverly.
"What? What did you see?"
"I saw something on Ian's face," Beverly says.
"What are you talking about?"
David asks impatiently.
"I saw Ian looking at Bradley when you brought him in."
"We were all looking at Bradley," Lauren says sharply.
"So what?"
"It's the way he was looking at him," Beverly says nervously. "What the hell do you mean?" Ian asks.
Now Beverly looks at Ian more boldly and says, "You were looking at him as if you were glad he was dead."
"What?"
Ian looks shocked.
"That's ridiculous," he protests.
"How dare you?"
Lauren exclaims, turning from Ian to glare at Beverly.
"I was right there beside him. He did no such thing."
Beverly turns on her and says with conviction,
"I know what I saw."
"You're imagining things,"
Lauren says. She flicks her eyes toward Ian.
"My wife wouldn't make something like that up,"
Henry says in her defense. His face flushes in the firelight, and he sounds belligerent.
"Why would she?"
Lauren can't think of an answer. David is startled at this outburst of Beverly's. He doubts the reliability of what she says. No one knows better than he how notoriously unreliable eyewitnesses are. They see a black car and think it was red. They miss things that are right in front of them and see things that aren't there at all. How much is she projecting her own fear?
Beverly had seemed fairly solid until now. Yet he had himself been suspicious of Ian ever since he sensed he might be lying about the death of his younger brother. He'd wondered about the sleeping pills, how much they could rely on Lauren, even knowing where Ian was the night Dana was killed. He, too, would like to know more about Ian. He would like to press him. Gwen watches this exchange, appalled. Beverly seems to be accusing Ian of being the killer. It seems impossible. He's so charming, so easy to get along with, and he has that wonderful smile. She thinks suddenly of that line from Shakespeare. Where was it from? One may smile, and be a villain. Her body has gone rigid, every muscle tight and stiff. Ian could have done it. He could have killed Dana while Lauren was knocked out with her sleeping pills. He was upstairs with Lauren when Candace was murdered, and he was running around in the dark like the rest of them when Bradley was killed. It was so dark. He could have done it. Lauren might be lying for him. Gwen clenches her hands tight. She looks across the coffee table at David, but she can't tell what he's thinking.
Something's been bothering me, David says, and now they all turn to look at David, who is watching Ian. Something about the story about your brother. What's that got to do with anything? Ian asks sharply. It's just that something didn't quite ring true, David says. What makes you think that? Ian asks, licking his lips nervously.
Gwen, watching, feels sick.
I can usually tell when someone is lying, David asserts.
He leans forward, out of the shadows.
Was there something more to that story? Something you aren't telling us?
He waits a beat and adds,
If there is, maybe you'd better share it with us now.
Ian swallows nervously and considers his position. David had caught him in a lie. He had lied about his brother. He feels cornered.
Okay,
Ian says, his voice low and distraught. He looks up at the attorney.
You're right. I didn't tell the whole truth about my brother. I don't see how that matters much right now, Henry says. Who cares about your brother?
David sends Henry a look to shut him up.
I want to know why he was lying. I've never told anyone this before,
Ian says nervously. He glances at Lauren.
I was 13, and Jason, he was 10. He could be difficult. I didn't like hanging out with him, keeping an eye on him. Jason wanted to go to the pond that day. He wasn't allowed to go by himself, so I went with him. But when we got there, we got into a fight about something stupid. He was so stubborn. I got pissed off, and I left. I left him there, alone. I didn't think he'd go in the water. He knew better.
He pauses, takes a breath, and exhales heavily.
When I got home, later, and we couldn't find him, I went back to the pond. He was floating there, dead. And I knew it was my fault for leaving him. I never should have left him there. I've had to live with that my whole life. I lied to my parents. They didn't know we'd gone to the pond together. I let them believe that he'd gone on his own, that it was just a fluke, that I was the one to find him. All these years, I've been living with the guilt, and my parents still don't know.
He looks up at the rest of them.
I don't know if I'm guilty under the law. I left him there alone, and I've been lying about it ever since. I probably knew he'd go in the water. I told you the same story I've told everyone, even my parents.
He looks at David. He's afraid to look at Lauren.
This is the first time I've told the truth about it.
He slumps back in his seat, exhausted.
Now you all know.
Chapter 30. Lauren watches Ian, her lover, through startled eyes. Then she glances at the attorney, tries to gauge what he's thinking. He looks as if he believes Ian now, but she doesn't know what to believe. Maybe it happened the way Ian says, or maybe Ian pushed his brother in. Maybe he held him down. He'd told her about his younger brother before, the original version, the lie. He's sitting close to her, their bodies touching, but now she pulls away. He looks back at her in consternation. "Why didn't you tell me the truth?" she says, her eyes glancing off his.
"I didn't even tell my parents. I couldn't tell you. I was afraid of losing you."
He looks back at her imploringly.
"I didn't mean for it to happen. Do you think I haven't blamed myself every single day since then? Do you think I don't feel guilty every time I think about my parents? Every time I talk to them?"
She turns her eyes away from him.
"Come on, Lauren. Don't let this come between us."
She doesn't answer him for a moment. Then she turns to him in the dark. "You should have told your parents the truth." It comes out sounding a little too pious.
"I was a kid," he says defensively.
Lauren shifts farther away from Ian on the sofa and speaks nervously, without looking at him. She feels everyone staring at her. She takes a deep breath and says, "You're not a kid now. And we have to tell the truth, Ian. It will come out eventually."
"What?"
Ian says, startled.
"What is it you want to tell us?"
David asks. She says reluctantly, "When we went upstairs after lunch, I know I said that we were together, but I went down to the little sitting room on the third floor to be alone for a bit, to read. Ian said he was going to have a nap. I wasn't with him." She feels Ian stir on the sofa beside her uneasily. "We weren't together all afternoon like we said."
"Why did you lie?"
Beverly says.
"Because I didn't think..."
Lauren's voice falters. "I still don't think that Ian had anything to do with this." Ian says,
"It's true that Lauren went to read in the sitting room in the afternoon while I was alone in our room. We probably should have said so. But I'm not a killer. That's ridiculous. It's not me."
He turns to Lauren.
"You don't think it's me, do you?"
He sounds a little worried.
"No."
She shakes her head, but she sounds uncertain, and she knows it. She can hear it in her own voice. Perhaps they all can.
"Why on earth would anyone think it's me?"
Ian asks. He looks nervously at the others seated around the fireplace.
"Why me? It could be anyone."
"It might be you," Lauren whispers suddenly. "Maybe I've just been too blind to see it."
"What?"
Ian splutters.
"Lauren, come on."
He looks genuinely alarmed now.
"This is insane."
"When Dana was killed, I just assumed that you were with me all night."
"I was with you all night. I never left the room, I swear."
He runs his hand through his hair nervously.
"And how would you even know? You were asleep."
"That's just it, Ian." She looks doubtfully at him now. "You know I take sleeping pills. I took 2 on Friday night. You knew I took them. You could have left our room for hours, and I wouldn't have known."
"But that doesn't mean I did."
He runs his hands up and down his thighs.
"So you can't vouch for me being in the room all night?"
He looks uneasily at the others.
"So what? None of you can prove where you were all night. Why are you pointing the finger at me?"
He says,
"I think we all need to take a step back here. We're all getting a little paranoid."
Lauren glances at the others in the room. Their eyes are all trained on Ian. She shrinks farther away from him. "But I wasn't with you in the afternoon either."
"So now you think I might have killed them?"
He shakes his head furiously.
No. Why on earth would I kill 3 people?
He He looks around at the others as if for validation.
You'd have to be crazy.
Maybe you are crazy. Beverly has spoken, and Lauren turns to look at her in surprise.
I saw the way you looked at Bradley when you brought his body in here.
What? I don't know what you're talking about,
Ian protests.
You're mad,
he says, glaring at Beverly.
I'm not the one who's mad,
she cries, her voice shrill as Ian shrinks back into his chair, a look of fear on his face. Lauren watches it all, her eyes wide. Ian sizes up the situation and doesn't like it at all. He doesn't like the way everyone is staring at him.
I'm not a killer,
Ian says more quietly.
Lauren and I weren't together for part of the afternoon. It doesn't mean I murdered three people in cold blood. You have no reason to suspect me.
Lauren looks at him, her face pale, and says, But how could you lie to your parents like that for all those years? How could you do that? Maybe you're not who I thought you were. She lurches up suddenly and moves to the other sofa a few steps away. She sits down beside Gwen and looks back at him with something like fear in her eyes.
Lauren,
he begs her, but she turns her head away. She won't even look at him. Gwen watches all of this, feeling like she's going to be sick. She wants to vomit up all her fear and grief and guilt and get it all out of her. She doesn't know what to believe. She doesn't want to believe that Ian may be the killer, but she has to admit it's possible. They must survive until the police arrive. Let them figure it out. But God only knows when they'll get here. She's even more frightened now. She no longer feels there is safety in numbers. She thinks of Riley out there in the cold, probably dead. She wonders if anyone else will die. Matthew broods in the dark, staring malevolently at Ian. Suddenly he leans forward and says,
Why should we believe you? Believe what you like, Ian growls back. The police will get here eventually, and they'll believe me. There's no evidence at all that I killed anyone, because I didn't kill anyone.
He turns to Lauren,
and you'll know I didn't do it too.
Matthew sees Lauren looking at Ian, as if wanting to believe him.
You lied about your brother,
Matthew says. Ian doesn't answer. Matthew lets his voice grow quieter and more menacing. Maybe it still didn't happen the way you said. Maybe you killed your brother. Maybe you drowned him on purpose, because maybe you're a killer. Maybe you're just made that way. Matthew glares at him accusingly. Everyone remains frozen, watching.
No.
I don't believe you, Matthew says. I think you killed Dana, and I have no idea why. He stifles a sob. I'd like to strangle you myself. David stirs, as if ready to jump in. Matthew finds himself standing now. David rises too and steps in front of him and puts a hand on his chest. Matthew is taller and broader, but David's hand is firm against him.
I didn't kill her, Ian protests. I didn't kill anyone.
Sit down, Matthew, David says firmly. Matthew hesitates, and then, grudgingly, he sits. David slumps back down into his seat, his heart beating fast. For a moment, it looked like Matthew was going to attack Ian. Emotions are running dangerously high. People who are frightened can be unpredictable and dangerous. David knows he must not let his guard down for even a minute. Beverly shivers beneath her blanket and watches the others carefully. She's convinced that she saw something odd cross Ian's face when he looked at Bradley's body on the lobby floor. And now Lauren herself has said that she wasn't with Ian the afternoon that Candace was killed. And that story about his brother, that gave her the chills, too. What kind of person can lie to their parents about something like that for years? He's cold. That's what he is. Matthew obviously believes Ian is the killer, too. Beverly asks herself what Ian, or anyone, has to gain from these murders. If there's a connection here, none of them can see it. Whoever is doing this is mad. And that's what scares her the most. Because if someone is killing for the fun of it, because they want to kill, because they can't help it, rather than for a real reason, then all bets are off. You can't know what they're going to do, where they'll stop. You can't know how much risk they'll take. Perhaps Ian is planning on killing them all. Perhaps at some point, before first light, he will start laughing and slaughter the rest of them. Maybe, Beverly thinks, it's finally dawned on that foolish Lauren what might happen. She looks scared out of her wits. Gwen wants to close her eyes and sleep. She wishes she were home safely in her own bed. She wishes the police would come. She's exhausted by fear and grief and guilt. She can't stop thinking of Riley, out there alone in the freezing cold, and she's the one who's responsible for bringing her to this terrible place. Furtively, she watches the others through tear-swollen, half-closed eyes. Her heart breaks for James, who has just lost his son. He looks like he will never recover. Well, that makes two of them. She tries to feel sympathy for Matthew, but she doesn't trust him. Ian looks frightened. He doesn't look like a murderer at all, but perhaps that is all for show. She must not fall asleep. She gives her head a little shake, trying to stay awake. Gwen catches David's eye across from her, but she cannot tell what he is thinking. Does he think Ian is the killer? If Lauren was in the sitting room, then they can't be sure where Ian was when Candace was killed. But then they can't really be sure where any of them were at the time of the killings. That's the problem. It's all so confusing and unclear, and she's so tired she can't think it through. She drifts off for a moment, and then wakes with a start. She shifts her position, fighting to stay awake. This is her second night of almost no sleep. She wishes again that she had something to protect herself with. But the truth is, even if she had a knife, she doesn't think she could use it. If the killer came for her, or for someone else, could she plunge a knife into his neck? She looks at Ian, staring moodily into the fire. Could she plunge a knife into Ian's neck? She studies his neck, the Adam's apple that protrudes ever so slightly. She watches him swallow in the firelight, unaware of her scrutiny, of what she's thinking. She doesn't think she would have the guts. She shivers beneath the thick wool blanket that covers Lauren and her. She reaches for Lauren's hand beneath the blanket and holds it. Lauren squeezes her hand back. Sunday, 4:05 a.m.
We should kill him, Henry says into the dark without warning, before he kills us.
David feels the small hairs on the back of his neck stirring. It's as if everyone has stopped breathing. He takes a deep breath and says, his voice outraged beneath the evenness,
Don't be ridiculous, Henry. We don't know that Ian killed anybody.
Henry says recklessly,
It's him or us.
He's in no mood to listen to reason, David realizes. They are all reaching the breaking point. Perhaps Henry has just reached it first. David glances quickly at Ian. He looks petrified. David gets angry then, at the recklessness of it.
We can't just murder him. Why not? Henry says. It would be self-defense.
David shakes his head at Henry.
You fool, he says, raising his voice. It would be murder in cold blood. We don't know that he killed anyone. Look at him, cowering in his chair. There are seven of us, and only one of him. Do you really think you can kill him and get away with it? You want to be judge, jury, and executioner all at once?
He can't help it. The outrage has taken over and comes through loud and clear. Henry grudgingly settles back into his chair, his face hidden in shadow. Sunday, 4:59 a.m. Henry's eyes flutter. He's having a dream, a very unpleasant dream, that he is paralyzed, that he can't move, can't act. He's had this dream before. It's symbolic, of course, but it has never seemed so real. He's held fast inside this nightmare. He can't move his arms or legs, not even his fingers or toes. He cannot move his tongue, which feels thick in his mouth. The only thing that is alive is his brain, his mind. He realizes now that something is terribly wrong. He'd been sleeping, but this isn't a dream. He tries to speak, but he can't open his mouth, can't form any words. It's difficult to swallow. He thinks his eyes are open, but he can't move his eyelids, and all is darkness. He can't see anything. It's as if a black film has fallen over his eyes, like that moment before you pass out. He knows he's dying, but he can't tell anyone. He wants to flail and thrash to get their attention, but he is unable to. He knows where he is, even though he can no longer see. His sense of smell is still working, and he recognizes the scent of the logs burning in the fireplace. It reminds him of Christmases as a boy. He's still in the lobby of Mitchell's Inn, and the murderer has got him, too. Chapter 31. Sunday, 6:30 a.m. Outside the hotel, wild things scurry and howl in the forest. The wind has dropped to a whimper. The sky is just beginning to lighten in the east, but inside, it is still dark and quiet as the grave. Suddenly, the chandelier overhead flickers and turns on, flooding the lobby with light. The remaining guests stir and look up in surprise. There are sounds of whirring and clicking as various parts of the hotel come back to life. The power is back on. David, who hasn't closed his eyes all night, glances first at Gwen, who appears to be asleep, her dark lashes a smudge against her pale face. She's breathing peacefully, for the moment at least. Lauren is curled beside her. He shifts his eyes next to Beverly. She's looking at him, blinking in the sudden brightness. "The electricity's back," she says with feeling. "Thank God." At the sound of her voice, Gwen stirs, opens her eyes. Lauren straightens up suddenly on the sofa. "Hallelujah," she says. Matthew and Ian shift beneath their blankets. David doesn't know if they were ever really asleep, but they're wide awake now. James is slumped in his chair. His eyes are open, and David can't tell if he slept at all. Now Beverly gives a startled cry, and they all quickly turn her way. She's staring at Henry. "Henry!" Beverly cries. Her face is aghast, and she shakes his arm. But there's no mistaking that Henry is dead. He's perfectly still in his chair, his head thrown back, his eyes closed, his mouth open. In the light of the chandelier, his face has a hideous pallor. "Henry!" Beverly shrieks again, shaking him harder, panicking. David rises swiftly and goes over to Henry, but there's nothing to be done. Beverly is now sobbing hysterically. David looks up and meets Gwen's eyes and sees pure fear. James slowly gets up and makes his stumbling way to the reception desk. David watches as James dials the number, his hands shaking, and realizes he's holding his breath. To his profound relief, the phone appears to be working. At last. James speaks into the phone, his voice breaking. "We need help." Sunday, 6:45 a.m. Sergeant Margaret Sorensen, 40-ish, stocky, blonde hair going gray, always an early riser, is enjoying her Sunday morning coffee at home in her favorite, least flattering flannel pajamas,
when she gets a call from one of the officers at the station.
Ma'am, we've got a situation out at Mitchell's Inn.
Officer Lachlan sounds tense, which is unusual. He's generally a laid-back sort, especially good with community events.
What kind of situation?
She asks, putting her coffee cup down.
We just had a phone call from the owner there, James Harwood. He said at least 3 people have been murdered, maybe more.
Is this a prank? She asks in disbelief.
I don't think so, ma'am.
She can tell from his voice that he doesn't believe the call was anything but genuine. Good God, she thinks, shocked.
We need to get out there, ma'am.
He's breathing quickly, shallowly, down the line. Who have you got there?
Perez and Wilcox. We'll get the snowmobiles ready. No other way out there at this point.
I'd better let the chief know. I'll be there in 10 minutes. Good thing she lives so close to the station. It's just around the corner. Sunday, 7:35 a.m. Sergeant Sorensen pushes the snowmobile hard over the ice-covered snow up the long, winding drive to Mitchell's Inn. She has gunned it as fast as she can all the way from town. A triple homicide. Things like this are rare up here. They don't even have a detective at the station. She will have to do until New York State Police can send someone. Officer Lachlan had briefed her more fully when she arrived at the station, but the facts are sketchy. 3 guests and the owner's son are dead, and another guest is missing. She is shocked. She doesn't know what they might be walking into. She's familiar with the hotel and with the family. Young Bradley, dead. She can hardly believe it. Her adrenaline is pumping fiercely as they approach the final curve in the long drive. She cuts the engine outside the hotel on the brittle, glittering lawn. She reaches for her gun and gestures to the other officers parking their snowmobiles to do the same. They approach the front entrance cautiously, their heavy boots sliding on the ice. It's so cold she can see her breath. Sorensen notices a smear of blood on the ice near the front porch and silently points it out. She creeps up the side of the porch steps and looks in the window. Finally, she pulls open the front door, her weapon ready. It opens easily. She steps inside the lobby, and her eyes automatically turn toward the group around the fireplace. She sees pale faces peering out from blankets, staring back at her. She thinks, I will always remember this moment. She hears the 3 officers coming in behind her. She takes in everything with her quick eyes. The people sitting around the fire look haggard and disheveled, as if they haven't slept. As if they've survived some kind of siege. She recognizes James, blindsided by the loss of his only son. She feels a stab of pity for him. She counts 8 survivors sitting around the fire. No, make that 7. On closer inspection, 1 of the chairs is holding a corpse. She approaches the small gathering, holstering her weapon. I'm Sergeant Sorensen, and these are... She indicates each with a nod of her head. Officers Lachlan, Perez, and Wilcox. We're here now, and we're going to help you. She tries to sound authoritative and reassuring at the same time. Sorensen steps forward to look more closely at the dead man. She can't tell from looking at him whether he was murdered or died of natural causes. She takes in the pallid faces looking up at her and wishes fervently that the medical examiner and the forensics team were here with her. She has no idea how long it will be until the roads are passable. She's on her own here. For now, I'm afraid everybody has to stay put, she tells them. There's no way to get you all safely into town. We're going to take a look around, then I will have questions for all of you. When the roads are clear, you will be taken into town to the station to give official statements. In the meantime, I need all of you to help me as much as you can. She gets a few weary nods in response. Before I look around, I need someone to put me in the picture here. Just a quick overview for now. Her eyes light on a man in his late 30s with an intelligent look about him. What's your name?
she asks in a friendly way.
David Paley.
She pulls up a chair and sits down beside him.
Maybe you could tell me who everybody is, and then tell me what happened.
She listens grimly as he gives her the story. When he's finished, she says to them all, "We'll look for Riley just as soon as we can." After that, Sergeant Sorensen instructs Perez and Wilcox to remain in the lobby to ensure the safety of the survivors. She keeps Lachlan with her to take notes and as a second pair of eyes and ears. She does a quick walk through the hotel and its environs with Lachlan by her side. They start in the lobby. She pulls a pair of latex gloves out of her pocket and puts them on, then walks over to the bottom of the staircase, feeling the eyes of the survivors on her back. She squats down, notes the blood on the edge of the stair. She looks up to the top of the staircase and back down again. She motions Lachlan to follow her. She climbs the staircase, hardly making a sound. How quiet the stairs are, she thinks. All she can hear is the squeak of her boots. She continues to the third floor, Lachlan behind her. They arrive at the room to the left of the stairs across the hall, number 306. Taking the key that James had handed her, she opens the door carefully with her gloved hands. She flicks on the overhead light. Inside, she sees the body of the second victim slumped on the floor, her scarf still wound tightly around her throat. She and Lachlan take a close look, careful not to disturb her. Next, they visit room 302, the room that had not been made up. She takes in the messy bed, the unwiped sink. She glances wordlessly at Lachlan, who purses his lips. Forensics will go over this room with a fine-tooth comb when they get here. The two of them make their way back down the stairs and out through the woodshed and the bitter cold and down the path to the ice house. When they step inside, the first thing she sees is Bradley's body lying near the back wall, the only color in the glittering, translucent interior. She stops, takes a deep breath. She knew what she was going to find, but still, it's hard to see Bradley stiff on the snow floor, dead. She takes a closer look. Such a fine-looking boy. Such an awful blow to the head. Beside him, another body has been placed on the floor against the wall. It's wrapped tightly in a white sheet. "Might as well unwrap her," she says. Lachlan puts on a pair of gloves and carefully pulls the sheet partly away. They look down at the woman's frozen face, distorted by death. She can see that she was beautiful. She's dressed in a negligee and a navy satin robe. Seeing her there, dead, lying in an ice house so scantily clad, Sorensen shivers involuntarily. Christ, what a horror show, she says with feeling. She leans down and studies the head wound. Eventually, she stands up. I want to see where Bradley was killed. They head back inside and then go out again through the front door. Outside, they follow the smears of blood. The spot where Bradley was killed is about 30 yards from the hotel. There's an impression in the icy snow and a dark red patch of blood where Bradley fell. She sees the boot scraper in the ice a couple of feet away. She gives it as thorough a look as she can with her bare eyes and then turns away, sick at heart. She looks back at the hotel and says to Lachlan, "What the hell happened here?" Lachlan shakes his head. Back in the lobby again, Sorensen pulls Perez and Wilcox aside and explains the situation. The two of you need to search this hotel thoroughly, from top to bottom. Check all the nooks and crannies, the closets, the cellars, the attic, if there is one. Take James with you if he's up to it. Treat him gently. He's just lost his son. Check outside, too, and all the doors and windows, every outbuilding. We need to be absolutely sure there is no one else here, and that no one else was here. Will do, Perez says. Meanwhile, Lachlan and I will search the area in front of the hotel for Riley. She adds grimly, she can't have got far. Outside, she and Lachlan stand at opposite sides of the broad lawn where the scrub begins and start their sweep, working toward one another and out again as they proceed.